Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season's in full swing. Apple fails to impress, and is QE3 on the table? Got a futures update today. We'll be talking about this with our guest Kevin Hoffman and John Markman. All this and more on episode number 235 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. The last week of 2011, folks. Hopefully you've been playing the game and checking out what's going on in these markets. It's been a wild ride over the last several weeks. You know, it took 11 weeks or so to bring the markets down by about 15 or 20%, and it took like, 6 days to bring it back most of the way. Not most of the way, but a good chunk of the way in a real interesting V-shape. And if you've ever studied V-shape recoveries, whether it's economic or whether it is from a stock market position, you know, those are often prone to see a little bit of a retracement. We're going to talk about that in a minute. A couple things I want to mention, though. We have been nominated, I think I mentioned this, for the Podcast Awards. Actually, the Disciplined Investor is up for the People's Choice Awards. This is going to be the last week you can actually vote for it. Go over to podcastawards.com and vote for whether it's DH Unplugged or The Winning Investor or this show, The Disciplined Investor, over in the People's Choice Awards. And all you do is put your name and your email address and click the button. You could do it once per day per email address. So those of you that have many email addresses, you can go to town on that. And then I'd really appreciate it because we'd love to get a little bit of an award there. Also, you can follow me at Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. And just to mention, this show is sponsored by GoToMeeting, but we'll get into that in a little while. I thought we would start out the show today with a quick overview of some of the market conditions and welcome Kevin Hoffman, who works here at Horowitz & Company. How you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you again. It's been a while. Well, I see you all the time, but I think everybody else is probably thinking it's nice to hear from you. You get all sorts of great emails after you come on the show. People just, they love you. What is it?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe just because I just tell it how it is.
Exactly. So give me an update. Kind of give us a flavoring of what's happening in the current market conditions and what we saw last week, some of the interesting features of what kind of like you've seen.
Yeah, you know, I mean, looking back at, over the past couple of weeks, we've seen the market bob up and down and up and down from about 1,100 on the S&P all the way up to about 1,220, 1,230-ish. We just briefly eclipsed that 1,230 level. I guess that was on Friday. But we're still seeing high levels of volatility. The VIX index is up 10% on the week, and we're still above that that 30 handle on the volatility index.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of, you know, not a great place to be.
But what does a VIX of 30 really mean? I mean, basically what they're saying is that the futures traders are saying that into the future for the next year out, they see a 30% swing potential
right
in the indices or, let's say the S&P 500, for example.
Yeah, that's the old adage is, you know, they're pricing options basically at a level that allows for a lot more swing in both. It could be positive or negative. It's
right.
Not necessarily that the market's moving down, although, you know, the VIX is generally correlated higher as the market is moving down because that's when we see the highest amount of volatility.
Right.
When the market's moving up in a general direction like we saw from back in 2007 to, or I guess it was 2003 to 2007, you know, we had some of the lowest levels of VIX in history,
right?
Because the market was just, you know, moving up at a slow, easy pace. You know, I don't think we saw more than like 50 basis points in a day back then.
Right.
But you know, right now we're seeing anywhere between 1% and 4% moves.
Yeah, and that's almost the usual here. The other thing is about the VIX of last week. You know, the markets ended up generally up last week. Well, the NASDAQ was down 1.1-1.2%. A lot of that had to do with Apple, which we'll talk about, and also some Google and some other of the plays out there. But, you know, when you look at the volatility metrics, you know, we're looking at an interesting phenomenon because there still is this fear of a global slowdown and the European. And that's kind of like, you know, this cloud that's been hanging over. What else? Give us some of the other specs on last week. What was the kind of the flavor for on the rotation?
We saw a lot of stuff going on last week, but we saw a lot of the defensive sectors being played out much better on the I guess that was like a couple weeks ago. We saw the utilities doing much better,
right.
But you know, now we're starting to see the discretionaries and the generally more riskier asset classes. I mean, financials were up 2.37% last week. Materials were up 2.55%, and we had the discretionary, which is the best of the bunch.
Actually, I think that was just Friday, but the financial did a lot better through the one day. But yeah, you're right. The rotation throughout the week, we talked about how we saw this on and off, kind of like every other day over the past 10 trading days. There was this one day on up, one day off, down, and then we finally came out of the week with a 2 day up,
right?
Which was interesting, and that was on options expiration.
Yep.
You know, and you and I have looked at that option expiration. I think we've talked about it here that, you know, when you look at, and I challenge anybody to take a look at a chart of the S&P 500, NASDAQ, the Dow. When you see the 5 days or 6 days that are leading up into options expiration, which is the third Friday of the month, there's usually a bit of a pattern that you see that it's a, you know, the slope and slant of the movement of the market. Let's say that it's going up in the 5 or 6, 7 days prior to the options expiration, what you'll see often is right afterwards a reversal down the other side. And some of that has to do with the way that the option bets are being played in the market. So if there's a lot of play, let's say, on a round number like 1,200, 1,150, 1,250, they're going to try to ramp it up so the puts don't get played out, for example, on those that were selling the puts or those that have the calls maybe want to, you know, be in the money. And they have the power to do that through the futures, which we're going to talk about in a minute with John Markman.
That's right.
But what we found is that there was this really odd reversal over the next 3, 4, 5 days.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's because people are protecting their positions, and then they're unwinding them the day after.
Right.
Or the next week. I mean, you have a huge lot of positions. If you have a huge institutional bank or whatever that has a large sale of either calls or puts, depending on what the level is, they're going to push it as far as they can up to those levels to make sure that they don't have to pay anything.
Right. And we saw also last week one of the interesting things that came back to the market is we're seeing a different type of M&A activity. El Paso's being bought. Actually, one of the stocks that we had for a while, Brigham.
Yeah.
But those are both in the same sector, the oil and gas exploration and that whole energy sector, which helped pop a few things. Matter of fact, two of the stocks that we have in our portfolios now are what I would call probably potential takeover targets if we would expand the whole discussion of why these plays, whether it's the Permian Basin or Bakken Shale or any of these areas, are really going to be very popular. And, you know, the whole fracking idea is going to really be something they're going to be looking to get into. So you got a cheap play on a lot of these stocks. Look at Gulfport Energy or RPC. These things have dropped, you know, 30, 40, 50% from their highs, just like the ones that were recently bought. And these guys, I think, are going to have a lot of tailwind that's going to really be helping them for a bit. And what we did was, you know, in the Stocktoberfest that we've been doing on a regular basis, if you haven't done it, you got to go check it out. It's really cool. Kevin, you did a great job, by the way, putting together the engine behind the Stocktoberfest, where we can analyze a stock on the fly with all of our particular indicators and our analysis. And we actually have, you know, last week, what did we do? We did Trina Solar. We did Prudential. We did Comcast. We did Green Mountain Coffee on Friday. That was kind of interesting, though. That one took a bath last week, Green Mountain, huh?
Yeah, it sure did.
Einhorn came in and said, you know, this doesn't look like it's a good idea. They did come out with an announcement on Friday where they're going to have now the single cup selling in grocery stores or something like that.
Yeah, I tell you what, that Stocktoberfest has been a real big hit. We had a lot of people come in and request that.
I know.
And at the beginning, it was kind of scary because a lot of the stocks were not looking very good.
Right, right.
According to, you know, our models and whatever. But, you know, now we're starting to see a little better quality stocks come in. And we've also seen the market conditions improve dramatically as far as, you know, where we see the market going.
So. Right. And the actual one of the things that why the stocks are looking better, in other words, their technical scores got a lift. So we break this down into three different components usually. One is a quantitative scoring, but that's what we do in the background when we pick our stocks. So we couldn't really use that for the stocks that you sent us. So what we did was we used our fundamental, our F score, and our T score, our technical score, to come up with a total weighted average of the two. So, like, for example, next week we have Sekonom that Patrick sent in, and Apple, Ken sent in, and what else do we have? We have a few more. Las Vegas Sands from David, Baidu from Marty. We got also JP Morgan, Duke Energy. We got lots of good stuff coming up next week on Stocktoberfest. So you go over to the disciplinedinvestor.com and check that out. But you know what? We're going to use the same format now and talk about Gulfport Energy, which is actually one of the top ranked positions that is in our whole entire universe in terms of energy right now, right?
Yeah, I mean it scores almost the best you can do as far as the quant-funded technical scoring system, and you know we're seeing great fundamentals out of this company, and although right now our fundamentals really aren't playing out in the marketplace right now, but you really want to watch these technical levels because you can get caught up in not liking a stock, whether it be I hate this company because I lost money in it last week, or I hate this company because it's always burned me every time I buy it. But, realistically, it's always the technicals that you have to watch, and those should really be your indicator for short-term trades. And right now, we're seeing some really good technical levels on Gulfport. We've saw it break out from its range here when it just bumped above, I guess it's right over... Right over about that $31
mm-hmm.
level
mm-hmm.
should be right where it should be breaking out, and I think we saw it close about $31.15 on Friday. So, we're getting some decent volume coming in. The volume, one of the things we like to look at is that up down volume ratio, because that really shows are people really coming in to buy this thing on positive days. Are people really pushing it up? A lot of times you see volume not being there on the push higher. And that's really kind of concerning because you really want some institutional backing or some mutual funds coming in to push that stock up a little bit higher. Also on the technicals, we've seen we have something called an M score, which is kind of like a momentum score, and how it's played against some of the peers within its index and how it's performed against the S&P 500. And it has scored almost in the top 99 percentile.
And it was the best.
Yeah, the best. Yeah. Right. So this stock has done really well against its peers over the past year.
Now what I thought was also interesting. The last report that we put out and we looked at, there was a pretty good spike in insider buying. It was like a 20% increase in insider buying. And I thought it was really kind of interesting, especially when you saw that a lot of companies were there was some buying going on, but in this sector there wasn't as much. And this showed a nice increase there. This is pretty much institutionally owned by hedge funds, clearly, investment advisors, a couple of insiders own a big chunk of it. Bank of New York, Neuberger, Guggenheim owns a ton of it. What I like is that if you look at the EPS over quarter, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, they've done really, really well in the past. And, you're talking about, EPS growth of over 100% on a quarter over quarter basis, not from last quarter to this quarter, but I'm talking last year to this year as far as the quarters go comparing. But they're also looking to the estimates look really nice. They're starting to taper back a little bit, and that just maybe because of we're starting to see some the producer price index is really moving higher, and that maybe is trouble for some of these materials companies coming into the new year.
Mm-hmm.
So
price target on this by the average analyst is about 37, which is about a 20% implied upside for this. It's a bit speculative. Anytime you'll see the oil and gas move up or down in terms of pricing and the commodity, you can see this move.
And they're volatile, too.
Very volatile.
These are very volatile. So it's either you take a smaller position and you stick with it, or you find some good points on the outsides and you play those.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, or it's interesting that you mentioned that, I think. You mentioned before the whole concept of, well, the fundamentals can be great, but I keep getting burned on the stock maybe, right?
Right.
Because the truth of the matter is that it's important to have the best fundamentals for a longer term, because those will play out, assuming they don't crumble.
Right.
But you could buy a great stock at the wrong time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And it doesn't matter.
Yep.
You can buy a crappy stock at the right time, and it's a total, it's a total winner.
Yeah, it all depends on your time horizon. It really does.
Exactly. All right, and then we also talked, let's quickly talk before we get to John Markman, about... just RES for a quick. This is RPC Industries. Very similar kind of name in that it's in the oil field business, and they do a lot more of, I guess they're more like a, not a Halliburton, they're more like a Flowserve Halliburton. They're more of a service-oriented company.
Yeah, I would say so.
So more of the, and on Friday, Halliburton's numbers came out, and it wasn't really pretty compared to what expectations were, so this kind of dipped a little bit, and this is another play out there. But I will tell you, if there is a opportunity for some takeover between Gulfport and these various companies, I mean, RES is the symbol, RES, has, I think, a great potential because as we're seeing the need and the expansion of many of these oil fields, again, the fracking and in the various areas throughout the United States and the world, the need for replacement, the need for fixing, the need for parts, service, pump pressure, all these different things, you know, especially in, if you're going to do any offshore stuff, this is definitely going to be an interesting play that could do very well. It's also very volatile. And this one, its technicals look pretty lousy.
Yeah, it's not good. I mean, the fundamentals are right on par with the Gulfport Energy, the G-Port that we talked about previously. But we're seeing a lot of weakness in this company. And this is why it's, you know, it's kind of attractive to us from a speculative perspective in that, you know, we might be able to pick up some of this on an outside outside bet, maybe a smaller piece, and see how it works out for us. Because the technicals, as Andrew said, look really, really bad. I mean, we're talking about it's almost at its lowest levels we've seen over the past year.
Yeah. You know, if you just take a partial look at this, though, I mean, what I see right now is it's coming out of its swoon and it's consolidating.
Right.
And you could make that case.
Yeah, you could.
I can make the case it's going to go drop right back down below, too. I mean, if I had to, right? But what we're seeing right now is that I think the combination of a sloping down 50-day moving average, but at the same time, the volume is kind of just not really picking up very much. And I think the Halliburton thing also didn't help. But I think when you look at the overall play of the stock, I think you have about a $16 downside point where if you really wanted to play the outside, about 16 and change. Yeah. That's the kind of a long-term trend that we see. And if you do look at the overall growth of the earnings, I mean, we're talking about substantial, 300%, 1,000%, 340%, 142%. Estimates out, 89%, 71%, 45%. Those are pretty substantial numbers. And the revenue growth goes from, it's going to be coming down a bit because you're coming off a much larger amount. But, you know, you're up 115% in the fourth quarter of 2010, 79, 75, 63, 65, 44. So,
yeah, that's the one thing you just don't want to get caught up in, though. I mean, you can really think the fundamentals look amazing,
right,
but you know, it's the price that's always going to pay you.
Price,
you know?
That pays. And then finally, let's just talk about something because I think this is the whole key to your conversation about, man, I hate that stock, I love that stock, right?
That's,
you know,
right.
You love a stock, so you buy it and you hold on to it forever, and the thing just kills you.
Right.
You hate a stock, you
can't buy.
Somebody
could say that like U.S. Steel, you know.
Right.
It's got to be a great company, right? It's been around for forever.
Right.
You know, there's so many great things about it, but that thing is just in the tank.
I mean, you know, it may have a day or two here that's really good, but now you have a stock like, for example, you know, that we looked at Netflix, and for example, which we recently bought a little small piece of Netflix. They have earnings coming out next week, by the way. We just think they're terribly oversold, which doesn't mean that they can't be more oversold, but we've had them on our list for a while. We stayed away from them, and unless something really ugly happens, you got to think that Reed Hastings would come in and fix his mistakes. He's admitted, you know, profoundly that he's made a terrible mistake with the last movement of that.
Oh, yeah.
It was a marketing mistake is what it was.
Yeah,
it was a communication mistake.
Right.
He needs to take lessons from the Fed. so now, when you look at a stock and you say, oh, I love that stock, I hate that stock, you know, I would say, oh, man, I don't know if I could be investing in mattresses.
Yeah.
In a time where people are just not, you know, looking to really spend $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 on a mattress, I don't know when that time actually is ever.
Right.
Why would I buy a company that sells mattresses, right?
Yeah, I mean,
but we have to say, you know what? Let's look at the numbers. Let's not get skewed by, you know, what it is. So we picked up a couple of weeks ago. We picked up Tempur-Pedic, and this is a company that makes the mattresses, and they do some financing. And they're really a high quality company. They've really done well on beating earnings, right? And the score is good. And they came out with earnings last week. Prior to that, they were up 3-4% for a couple of days prior, and then they were up like 6.5% after the earnings came out. After everybody figured out what the earnings was, they had raised their guidance and on EPS and on overall margin. They did an $80 million buyback. So I mean, this company looks solid, right?
Yeah, they look great. I mean, the fundamentals on this company are immaculate. I mean, you can't. There's not a blemish on these things. It's unbelievable. I mean, the growth rate is slowing. But even though the growth rate is slowing, I mean, they're still positive on earnings and revenue throughout, I don't know, all the way back to 2009, which is impressive.
Right, and their recent breakout, if you look at that chart, it was in a long consolidation period. They broke out above the, it was about the $63 area. They broke out above on significant volume. That was a great fall through there. And if you look at that, it was kind of a mini, on a daily chart, it's like a mini inverted head and shoulders kind of look.
Right, right.
You know, like the bat. I call it the bat.
Yeah, that definitely the earnings were scary, though, because, you know, when we came out on the earnings, people kind of sold it off, but it was on really, really low volume.
I didn't understand that because
I didn't understand
the headline,
that
all the underlying numbers looked good. There was some discussion about possible margin issue in the future and all that, but everything looked really good overall.
Yeah, I mean, you could have picked that up. I guess it was down almost like 8% after market. I mean, you really could have got a deal there.
Yeah, but you know what? You wouldn't have been able to be filled with, oh, you know.
By yeah, you never know. I mean, there was probably only about 15,000 traded.
But. Yeah. All right, so you know, let's get John Markman on the phone, because I want to talk to Kevin has a good background in futures as well, and John does a great job in the whole futures area. Plus, he has some great things to talk about, because I talked to him earlier today about Europe, and he has some. I'm going to ask him about that. I want to mention to you that this podcast is sponsored by GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is one of those great services that you have where you can just actually collaborate so easily without the expense of flying or, you know, any kind of having to, you know, spend excess time in airports, driving, doing dinners that you don't want to do. So you can essentially be in your bathrobe having a high-powered meeting and just share your screen very easily. And everybody that is in that meeting can have an easy access to the information that you're doing. So you get to view what you're doing, have a voiceover IP conversation. At the same time, you can easily and very inexpensively set this up. GoToMeeting is free for 30 days, a trial for you. All you have to do is go to gotomeeting.com and put in the code podcast. That's gotomeeting.com. Put in the code podcast, and you will get a free 30 days unlimited of their entire service. You got to check it out. It's a really cool service. I really we use it, and I think it's something that you'd really like. Again, follow us over on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz, and make sure to vote for us on the podcast awards. So with that, we're going to bring on John Markman, because John is he's a pretty good guy. I think, John, do you think he's a good guy?
I think so.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Anyway, he's been around the block a few times. He knows about a lot of good history. He studies the cycles. He has a great program that he has for clients available for futures trading, which we'll talk about. And he is my go-to guy when I'm fetching about things like Europe, and I need somebody to straighten me out and saying, is this really what I'm reading? Anyway, you've done a lot of research on Europe lately, right?
Yes, I have, and I even had some Belgian waffles this morning just to get in the mood.
Perfect, perfect. So what's going on? There was there's a fix coming, supposedly. But you had a different discussion with me when we, off the podcast, we had a discussion, you and I, about kind of the way that Europe looks is somehow what we saw in history with the United States, right?
Right. Well, the United States of Europe, basically, are trying to put themselves together just like the United States of America did back in the 1780s. Mm-hmm. Back then, we had some great statesmen like Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, writing the Federalist Papers, really kind of explaining and deciding, you know, how a group of disparate organizations, in our case states, in Europe's case countries, could work together to be a united economic and political team.
But the problem is, they don't have a Hamilton, they don't have a Jefferson, they have Sarkozy, they have Merkel, and they have Bertolucci, and they have Papandreou, and
The person that they're missing is Hamilton. Now, Hamilton was a fascinating character in American history, a little bit overlooked because he never actually became president, but he's probably the most responsible of all of the founding fathers for the way that the country turned out. And his most important idea, and the idea that he had to really fight for against Jefferson and against Madison, was for a central U.S. Treasury. A treasury where all of the different states of the country could contribute, and that would disperse its wealth equally amongst the states.
But the difference is that it was still one country with separate states, and even though there is a similarity, it's not the same.
They were under different pressures. But remember, during the Revolutionary War, the northern states spent a lot more money on fighting off the British than the southern states. And so they went deeper into deficit than the South. But the South was being asked to contribute an equal amount as the North, and they were resisting. Mm-hmm. That's why Madison and Jefferson, who were from the South, were resisting. But Hamilton, who was from the North, he made them see why they all had to be in it together. And he created the Treasury, and the Treasury is the number one reason that the United States survived those early years.
Okay, so
and
now...
What Europe is trying to do...
Yeah, bring it all together. Bring it all together.
So what Europe is... Europe's problem right now is that they have many separate countries that are under the wing of this single currency, the euro. But there's no single treasury responsible for taxation and disbursement of funds and the creation of the actual money. So what we're seeing right now is like the birth pangs of what could be a true United States of Europe. And it's messy, and it's crazy, and it's, you know, there's lots of disputes and despair. But I think that if we witnessed the creation of the Constitution of the United States back there in the 1780s, we would have never thought it would get off the ground. But I think that Europe will get off the ground. It's just going to take a lot longer than people expected.
Now, one of the big things that we saw this weekend was that the reality of how much Greece is really falling behind is coming out, and they're now talking about 50 to 60% haircuts on the... Basically, a haircut, for those of you who don't know, basically is something like this, that, hey, you have a bond worth 100, well, we're going to chop it by a certain percent, and if you want to cash it in, that's what it is. And it's going to be, you know, they talk about being voluntary.
Haircut is a euphemism for a loss.
Right, exactly. But you don't want to use the word loss. You don't want to, you know, it's like, you don't want to say the word cancer. You know, you got to say something else, you know. You can't say these kind of things. You know, you can't say it's going backwards. You have to say that growth is slowing.
Yeah, exactly.
So
growth is slowing. It's not contracting, it's slowing.
Right, no contraction.
There's three things. I want to be sure people understand that there's three central things that the Europeans are trying to get organized right now. And first, I want people, your listeners, to understand that there's two main organizations in Europe that overlap but are not the same. There's the European Union, which does include England, okay, and then there's the Eurozone, which is all the countries that are part of the euro currency, and Britain is not part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these organizations have to agree on the new debt plan that is being proposed right now in Brussels. And so there's three parts to this new plan. One is the banks that lent to Greece have a big hole in their... let me back up a second. The first thing that needs to be done is they need to decide on how big a haircut or how big a loss the banks should take in order to allow Greece to breathe. In other words, to reduce the amount that they're willing to take from Greece, and therefore Greece doesn't have to spend as much out of their shrinking budget for mm-hmm. loans. So three months ago, the decision was that there was going to be a 21% haircut.
Mm-hmm.
Now it looks like there's going to have to be at least a 40% haircut, but they're pressing for a 60% haircut. Okay, so that's the first thing. The next thing is bank recapitalization. If the banks have to take those kinds of losses, they're going to have giant smoking holes in their capital accounts. So the banks need to be recapitalized. This new capital comes from the taxation in two places. It's going to come from the citizens of the people of the Eurozone, and it's going to come from private parties, private involvement. The question is, how much of public money is going to be committed to that? Right now, last week, it was thought maybe the number would be 80 billion euros. Now the number being talked about is 108 billion euros, and that's just that's a stretch. Private analysts say it's at least 200. I mean, the IMF says it should be at least 200 billion euros, and independents say it should be 275 billion euros. So the maximum plan they have right now is 108 billion. And independent analysts say it should be $275 billion. That's a huge differential, and that's where a lot of the pain is going to come from in coming months.
Here's the funny thing, John. Listen to this. I want you to listen to something though. I want to hold on because a lot of information you're giving us. I want you to. I'm going to repeat back to you something and tell me if I'm right. Okay, from what you just said. Basically, there is a big problem in Greece, and their bonds are potentially going to have to be written off to a larger degree to mark to market, because right now the banks are holding them at. They were holding them at, let's say, 100% of value. Then they were instructed to hold them at 21% of value. And the balance sheet of the banks now, the reality is when they have to take a haircut, it's basically saying to the banks, you really do have to. We allowed you to hold the values of the bonds up for a long time. You know, you're going to really have to mark to market properly at this point. So the truth of the matter is, we're talking about a difference in the accounting methodology will then cause the banks to have a giant hole, which they have already, by the way, because if you really looked at the real value of trying to sell those bonds. And if that is the case, the EFSF is going to come in and capitalize the banks. If they don't, they're just going to have to pour money into Greece. So it just depends on where the money's going to go.
The third element that I wanted to mention was this EFSF, this emergency funding mechanism. And currently, they had a stretch to make it worth 440 billion euros in it. And by the way, that's not real money. That's all borrowed money, including from some of the distressed states. And the question is now, the third element that they're trying to decide right now in Europe is, how do we make that $440 billion larger? There's a couple of plans. One of them is to allow it to be leveraged by about five times using various, you know, nefarious Wall Street techniques, or by using it as a an insurance fund rather than as a lending mechanism or as a loan guarantee mechanism, such that it would guarantee the first losses out of anything that it funds. Now, as far as the banks are concerned, the way that people should look at it is like this. Let's say that you went to the bank and you wanted to buy a house. The bank says, how much are you worth? And you say, I'm worth $1 million. And then they say, okay, well, if you have $1 million, you can buy a, you know, $3 million house. But now the government comes along and says, you know what, you don't really have $1 million. You think you have $1 million, but, you know, 60% of that is impaired. So you really only have $400,000. So now the banks have to, now you have to go back to the bank and say, I really only have, you know, $400,000. What can I buy for that? And that's where we are right now with the banks. It's like they've been going around saying that they're really rich, but they're really not.
Yeah, well, and at the same time, like I said, the government at this point has made it very clear that they're going to do anything they can to save their banks. And I understand that, obviously. But it's once again that nobody fails, creating more of a moral hazard in the area that if they do the recapitalization of the banks and they do keep on pumping money into Greece, you have to wonder, you know, where's the incentive for Italy, for Portugal, to do anything that is severe to get their debt to GDP in line?
This is an incredibly important point that you raise. Right now, Andrew, we're only talking about Greece.
Right.
Okay? Portugal has the same problem. Ireland has the same problem. Spain and Italy are verging on the same problem, and they're five times bigger than the other three. So, really, this problem is much larger than Europe can solve on a weekend. They say they're going to extend it to Wednesday. Okay. It's bigger than they can solve on Wednesday.
It's a rain delay. It's a rain delay.
Exactly. It's larger than they can solve on Wednesday. It's so large you can't even get your mind around how big a problem this is. And I'm not exaggerating.
Yep.
This is monumental. And I think that anyone who says that they know how it's going to end up is lying. But here's the thing that's really important. If the banks are made to recapitalize, which they will, and if they have to take these big haircuts and they're forced to recapitalize, they are going to have to shrink their loan books, which means they're going to have to lend less in Europe and around the world, because that will help them get under the new Tier 1 or capital requirement.
Yeah, they want 9%
now. So if you really think about it, what's happening now is the Eurozone political leaders are forcing the region into a recession.
But John, what about, you also, you know, you mentioned that we forgot to say anything about the other regions. By the way, the new name for those nations, you know how they used to be called the pigs? Now they're being called the gips, because I guess we have to be politically correct there too.
The gips?
Yeah, because frankly, the pig lobby got very pissed off. The hog lobby just came to Washington and said, that is just not acceptable. But no, seriously, they call them the gips or the gips. But here's the thing, you know, you didn't even mention about how much debt that is being held by banks and other nations outside of those. What about the U.S.? And what about the big concern for Morgan Stanley has been all about what they hold in these areas?
Okay, there's two things I want to say about that. Number one is, so far, we're only talking about sovereign debt,
right,
okay?
Right.
So there is a huge, but there's just as much corporate debt in Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy that is also being carried on the bank's books at full value, which will need to be brought down. So that's a whole other element that we're not even discussing here.
Yeah, why did they let them?
As far as the U.S. banks are concerned.
Yeah.
Let me just say that, yeah, the reason that most Americans should care about this is that most Americans who have a brokerage account also have a money market account. Wouldn't you say?
Yep.
You have money market. Mm-hmm. And everyone remembers who was of a certain age, let's just say. Back in the 1980s, it was very fashionable to sort of run from bank to bank, getting money market account rates of like 15, 16, 17%. Remember those days?
Oh, I remember.
Then Volcker comes in, and you know the interest rates go way down along with inflation.
Sport.
Until right now, money markets, about, let's say, 2 years ago, money market accounts were going for, let's say, 2%.
Mm-hmm.
Then they got down to 1%, and now money market accounts are going for, you know, are offering yields of less than 1%. Okay, but think about this: it's a $1 trillion industry, and even though the yields are less than 1%, they still have to compete against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So how do they do that? Well, some of them, and a lot of them, offer what they call enhanced or plus money market accounts,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and those accounts have a ton of exposure to European bank commercial paper, because if you run a money market fund and you have a wide variety of paper that you can buy that produces a yield, you can buy, let's say, GE commercial paper. Let's say it's going for 0.12% a year. If you want to enhance your yield, you can buy bank paper from Europe, BNP Paribas or Societe Generale, that's going for, let's say, 0.45 or 0.5% a year. It's giving more yield because it's more risky. And if you look in your prospectus of your money market funds, you'll be so shocked to see how many of them have exposure to this European bank debt because they're trying to get more yield.
Yeah, we've actually looked at that. We looked at a few of them, and we really interested because anything that we have our clients in, we want to make sure has, you know, relatively as little as possible of sovereign or any of the European. And
it should be zero.
Yeah.
It should be zero.
Well, it should be at this point because they've been selling the crap out of it over the last 2 months.
It should be zero because this is what we call risk without reward.
Yeah,
you know, if you're stretching to get 0.45% yield instead of 0.25% yield,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
That may look good if you're a money market manager, money market fund manager, and you're trying to, you know, be better than that next guy by a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a person at home, that 0.5%, 0.3% difference is meaningless.
Right.
And it's meaningless, and you should not expose yourself to money market funds with those kinds of commercial paper.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to get the other kind. The kind that you should want should have the name U.S. government. Securities only.
Right. You want to hear something interesting, John?
Hmm.
So we do a lot of business with Schwab Institutional, and we have a lot of money there. We have a couple different accounts over different brokers, interactive brokers, etc. Here's the thing. About less than a month ago, that,
yeah,
Schwab sent around a notification that there will be no new monies allowed to be invested in the Schwab U.S. Treasury money market until further notice.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they still allow you to do the U.S. government money fund, but they wouldn't let you go into the Treasury fund.
Interesting, huh?
And that's fascinating.
Yes.
Well, it may be some kind of a government policy to force people into buying European debt.
Ah, conspiracy. Speaking of that, let's kind of move on to the idea of talking about... just one point I want to make is that, in concluding this whole European issue, that France and Germany are on the opposite sides of the table of what they're looking for. France is more looking for a bank slash bigger guarantees because obviously they need them, and Germany is looking to say, okay, what do we got to do to get ourselves out of this deal in terms of with the least amount of money in? Because anything that happens, is no matter what it's going to be, will benefit more towards France than it would Germany. Would you agree with that?
The ultimate guarantor of all debts in Europe is Germany.
Right.
They want to make sure that they're guaranteeing the least amount of debt possible.
Mm-hmm.
The French are much more. The Germans want to have a country by country solution, so that, in other words, they want German banks, German government to take care of German banks, French government to take care of French banks. France wants an all three musketeers approach, all for one and one for all, because it's believed that the French government doesn't think that it can backstop French banks by itself. That's really where it comes down to.
I'll tell you the solution for all of this. They should stop taking those long lunches with wine in France.
I don't know about that. I think that's
all right. How about stop having the wine? Have it stop having the wine at meetings.
Well.
I hear you. They do that very well. They should figure out what to do with that. All right, let's talk a little bit about the idea of futures, because you and I have been talking a lot about that. That's something that you've really gotten very much interested in over the last number of years, I know. But you have this Gemini program where you have an algorithm or a program or a sophisticated measurement of when you should be looking at, let's say, treasuries, short-term treasuries, or maybe S&P futures and things of that nature. I want to just back up for a second and talk about the idea of utilizing futures. And we talked about this last time, about 8 weeks ago when you were on, but I want to talk about, you know, different things like margin requirements and maintenance requirements, just a little education about, you know, what it is. And I know that each different instrument has something, but let's start with like the S&P 500 E-mini futures.
So, right, the S&P 500 E-mini futures allows individuals or companies to speculate on the future direction of this S&P 500. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you wanted to buy spiders, the ETF or the exchange traded fund representing the S&P 500, you'd have to put up you'd have to put up the same amount of money. You'd have to buy 1,000 shares of spiders.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to put up let's say $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to speculate on the direction of the S&P 500 using futures, you put up a fraction of that, let's say $5,600, and then you control $66,000 worth of futures.
Okay, so there's a leverage involved.
It's just like options, except the premium is much, much lower, and you can hold them for 3 months.
Okay,
well, you can hold them even longer than 3 months. It just depends on the contract you buy, right?
That's right. You can hold them for longer than 3 months, but typically, in programs like ours, you know, Gemini 252, you're going to be holding your futures for generally anywhere from a few hours to a couple of days.
Okay. And every time you say the words Gemini 252, I got to put some music behind it, like a ta-da-da, you know, every time you say that.
We call it Gemini 252. 252 stands for two things. There's 252 trading days in a year, so the Gemini 252 program gives you a strategy for success every single trading day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But it also represents the fact that we trade three instruments: the Russell 2000, that's the 2, the S&P 500 futures, that's the 5, and the 2-year Treasury note, and that's the last 2.
You got to love a guy that has meaning to what's a Gemini mean?
Gemini refers to the rocket, because this is true rocket fuel for your portfolio.
Okay, so you call it Gemini 252.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll get some music behind that. We need a big like a symbol or something. We need something. So now, seriously. So when you invest in this,
I would prefer a drum roll.
A drum. Okay. So here's the deal. So let's talk about things that people should know if they ever want to trade futures. What's the deal on? There's something called initial margin, and there's something called maintenance. What's the difference? What does that have to do with anything? Because in an option, you just buy it and you buy whatever it is, right? You buy a one option and it's $1.50 times 100, whatever, and you buy whatever you want. And but futures are a little bit different.
Futures are a little different. They want you to have more margin or more collateral in your account if you're going to hold a position overnight than if you're just going to have it during the day. And that's the main difference between initial and maintenance.
So, what an initial right now for E mini is what?
The initial would be $5,600.
$5,600
overnight. To hold overnight.
Right
now, and at some brokerages, you could buy a single E mini future for as little as $500 margin. But you would have to buy it and sell it within the day.
Oh, so it's kind of like a day trading situation where you could do a 4x multiple for intraday day trading of stocks.
That's right.
Right.
I have to point out, most people lose money trading futures because they move very fast.
Right.
There's a lot of leverage involved. You can be very emotional. But the Gemini 252 program is very unemotional. It's mechanical. It's a well-tested product. And over this year, it's already up 86% through 27 trades. Now, 25 of those trades have been successful, and 2 are failures.
So it's kind of like the Mr. Spock versus Captain Kirk on Star Trek. So the emotional one is the traitor would be Captain Kirk, and this is more of the logical, pointed-eared, you know,
What's so interesting about the Gemini 252 algorithm?
You're going to keep saying that, and there's going to be more music on the show than you can imagine.
What's so interesting about it is that it's a counter-trend trading program.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not trend following. So what's interesting is that if the market on days when the market is up, let's say 2%, you'll get a signal from Gemini 252 which says short the S&P 500 E-mini future at such and such a limit price at the close.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wait a minute, the market was just up 2.5%.
Right.
It's now the instruction is to short it, and then as soon as you short it, then we send a new signal that gives you a target. And very often, obviously not every time, but most of the time, that target is hit either later that evening or the next morning.
Hmm. Interesting.
Where have you seen a lot of positions build up?
What's kind of fascinating is that you can make money with Gemini 252 with the on the short side as the market goes up, and you can also make money with futures on the long side when the market is going down. I'll give you a great example. This month in October, the market is up what? How much is the market up this month?
This month? I don't know, 10%, 8%, 10%?
6%.
6%?
Like
well, you knew the answer. What did you ask me for?
Good question. Well, Gemini has taken short positions overnight four times this month and is up about 7.5% in them.
Wow. That's on. Okay, I got you. I'm with you.
And that's why futures can be a great sort of small part of everybody's investment program, because obviously, you know, 95% of your money is going to be long in the market. You know, for most people.
Do you see this as a program for most investors, or is this kind of like a very risky thing for, you know, maybe higher net worth people?
You know, everyone needs to make that decision for themselves. What we're trying to do is bring futures down to the level at which any individual can trade them. Obviously, past results are no guarantee of future results, but we're trying to make the futures market, which has been really the exclusive playground of the rich and privileged, we're trying to bring it down, make it very, very simple for the average person to trade.
Yeah, where have you seen positions build up, I guess, as far as, I know we have access to some of this stuff, and we've seen sometimes where your position increases, but where have you seen leverage increase, and has that become a problem, or is it something that you're pretty comfortable with?
And how does the leverage increase?
In other words, you know, if you have, let's say, if you go short one S&P, and then maybe 2 days later you say, hey, you know what, we think that the counter trend's continuing and shorted at this level, and then maybe by the time, you know, I don't know, you may have a four
tailings.
Yeah. So you know, does that where does it get to be a concern at size that you have a lot of volatility potential? Is that right?
Right.
I understand. The system is very tends to be very confident about it. It's only start a trade if it's very confident that it will end successfully. And it starts a trade with an E mini trade with only a third of the potential capital that could be applied.
Mm-hmm.
So the first short, let's say, might be at 1,200. If the market does not move down to its target, let's say 1,190,
mm-hmm.
the next day, it will recommend shorting it again and then shorting it again a third time. And then it's always looking for a target, obviously lower than the initial target. And if one is not found in a reasonable amount of time, it will stop out.
Hmm. Okay. So there is some loss prevention, I guess is the best. Was that the right word? Yeah. Loss prevention.
Yes. Gemini 252 is very, very risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, this is a leveraged, highly leveraged and risky place to trade,
mm-hmm.
and you need to have loss prevention mechanisms in place.
Yeah, do you guys utilize stops and whatnot when you're trading with the Gemini?
So one thing that's interesting about Gemini is that it will average into a trade in the case of the S&P 500 E-minis or the Russell 2000 E-minis, it'll go in three times, scale in three times, and for the 2-year note, it'll scale in four times. And until it has a fully has a full position. It does not have a stop because, remember, it's trying to take advantage of the downside volatility or the upside volatility if it's short.
So,
and you'll only get a stop
if
once you're fully loaded.
Right. I got you. Because it's going to keep on trying to scale into the position because it's confident that right.
Exactly. You're trying to lower the average cost. A great example of this came back during the Japanese earthquake and tsunami back in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
The system, because the market was going down, the system wanted to go long, because it's a counter trend, and it went long the day before the earthquake.
Ouch.
And then the earthquake happened, and the market was down, I'd say 3% or 4%, whatever it was, and you got another signal from Gemini saying to buy it again, and you're like, are you kidding me?
Right.
But you got to do that because, generally speaking, your human reaction to the market is wrong, and Gemini's has tended to be right.
Hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then the market obviously went up. It came back down again when it looked like there was going to be a nuclear catastrophe. And on the 16th of March, when it was the worst for expecting a nuclear catastrophe, we got another buy signal on Gemini. Now at that time, people are saying, "Where's my stop?" But Gemini doesn't think that way. It says, "I want to lower my cost basis."
Mm-hmm.
So it buys a third one, and then 5 days later, the market shot back up, and we were able to exit that trade for about an 8% gain.
Nice. So what do you think about the whole futures market in terms of how there's a high correlation right now between stocks and indices, showing that there is a play into either ETFs, leverage ETFs, or futures that is just kind of pushing and pulling the markets? And that's what we see when there's a news item that breaks and markets are down, I don't know, 50 basis points or 1% in a second. That's not the retail trader, right? That's the futures, the ETFs playing out. Would you agree?
I think a lot of the extreme moves that we're seeing lately in short periods of time are not due to futures or ETFs specifically, but due to the high-frequency traders. Because those high-frequency traders, and I'm talking about these guys who have their servers basically in the next room from the NYSE servers.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the guys that are exacerbating the moves in various directions, and they have no there's no directionality bias for them. They just move in whatever direction they think is going to work for the next basically 5 seconds.
So, and then they just compound each other. One thing that worries me about high frequency trading has always been that their computers are trying to outsmart each other. I was at a conference last month, and there was a high-frequency trader that was speaking, and they were talking about how they put on, you know, 70 or 80 new people to actually in the firm to work on the trading systems and all that. Those were not analysts. Those were not anything more than engineers of computer technology, of statistics and things of that nature. Nothing to do with finance. To do with the actual, I guess, the logic of direction of movement and herd mentality, things like that.
The deal is, I think high frequency trading should be banned, and here's why. It absolutely depends on a special feed of information that they get from the exchanges that are not is not available to the public. Why this is legal, I have no idea. But they're allowed to find out what the order flow is like nanoseconds before it goes out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they make their money.
Mm-hmm.
And why do they allow this? Because the exchange makes a ton of money on that special feed.
Right, but one of the things they're also doing is they're throwing through garbage quotes, so that they're trying to nudge markets in a variety of directions and then pull in their quotes because they can do so quickly. They can just pop it in, pop it out, and try to move markets. Listen, is it any wonder that at 2 o'clock sharp every single day, you get an immediate pop-up in markets, and if it follows through, great, then there's a rush in. If not, you drop right down. In other words, they're set to pop the markets at certain points and a little bit Pavlovian style, and then, you know, just follow through if it goes. If not, if it falls under, they'll just whack the trade and move out and move the other direction.
Now, here's what's interesting. As humans, you and I are observing that. We're trying to, it takes us, you know, weeks or months to figure out exactly what the pattern is.
Mm-hmm.
Gemini is in a genetic algorithm, and it learns from trading every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's way ahead of our ability to humanly process that information.
Mm-hmm.
It already understands what the high-frequency traders are trying to do and tries to get out ahead of them on behalf of our subscribers.
Hmm. Interesting stuff. All right, so I know that we're going to have some information about Gemini on the website like we did last time, so everybody can go check out what's going on with that. I have another question for you, though, on the markets and the, we'll call it the what would we call it here? The playbook, you know, the game plan. So, you know, we talk quite often, and we talked about how, you know, end of last month into this month and what's going on and what may happen and, you know, the ECRI recession call. I have a question about that. Do you interpret the recession call or whatever is going on right now at ECRI? By the way, their number was down again last week, on down a negative 10 or so. Do you observe and consider what they did a call on a recession, or that it's more of a warning that this, you know, kind of peeking into that territory? Because I think I'm a little confused with that.
Oh, it's actually very simple. ECRI, it's the Economic Cycle Research Institute, mm-hmm. founded by Jeffrey Moore, and the principles of ECRI's methodologies are that there is a business cycle, and a boom and bust business cycle that is basically almost immutable. And if you need to be able to understand what that cycle is, both on a weekly, monthly, and a longer-term basis, in order to, if you're a business, to help you, you know, construct, you know, buy your inventories properly or hire people properly, or if you're an investor, to understand when recessions may occur. Because when recessions occur, earnings shrink and stocks fall. They saw fall an average of 40% from a high during a recession. So it's really important to understand this business cycle. What's really critical to understand is that ECRI has done a phenomenal job of accurately calling recessions before they occur, in a way that mainstream economists who do not believe in the cycle have not been able to do. So when last 2 weeks ago, actually on October 1st, I think, Friday, the director of ECRI, Lakshman Lakhvatan, announced that ECRI had determined that the United States was tipping into recession and that it was not possible to escape. Now, the markets went down on that Friday, and then on Monday they went down again. On Tuesday, they hit a new low and then shot right back up, and the markets have been going up ever since. And there's also been more recently some positive economic data out of retail sales and, you know, the Philly Fed, et cetera. And since the market's up 9% since that call, people have looked back and said, hey, maybe Lakshman, maybe ECRI got this one wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is nonsense, because the last two times ECRI made a similar forecast were March of 2008 and March of 2001. And in the case of 2001, the market did go up about 9.5% immediately after his call. And it hit the 10-month moving average of the S&P 500 and then absolutely collapsed, fell another 35%. In March 2008, the ECRI call was made, I think the same month, the same week that Bear Stearns went down and was bought by J.P. Morgan. And the market saw that as a final blow to what looked like the start of a bear market, and it shot up 15% after the ECRI recession call. And people were poo-pooing the recession call, saying that Lakshman had it wrong this time. But again, the market hit the 10-month moving average of the S&P 500, and then it collapsed, and it fell, as we everybody knows, about 42% from there into the low of the bear market. So what I've been saying to my subscribers is that we should expect the same thing to happen. You know, he made the call on that on the October 1st. We should look for a move higher of 9% to, you know, 14%, or at least to the declining 10-month average of the S&P 500, which is right now around 1280 on the S&P. And once it hits that level, I think you can expect some selling. I think you can expect a lot of selling. And why is that? Because I think at that point, the evidence of the coming recession will become more clear.
You know, it's interesting if you think about
that. What people have to recognize is that he's making a forecast. He's not making an observation.
Right. No, I understand.
So if you make a forecast, it happens. It's something he's talking about, something that he expects to happen in the future, not at the moment.
Well, that's the distinction, isn't it? Is between economists, they're making more observation because they want to be right. It's like kind of analysts that they bring down earnings after the guidance goes down, you know, so you know,
exactly.
they do it kind of to look good. But I was going
to
say something.
People are not used to people like ECRI, Lakshman saying, giving a 100% certain call. He doesn't say 60% likelihood, 40% likelihood. He said no, 100%.
Well, we're going to be seeing, because next week we have, on Friday, we have the GDP, the outlook for third quarter, where estimates are going to be 2.4%. They actually were, the prior was, 2.5% is the GDP. Last one was, prior was 1.3, so they're knocking it up a little bit, which is a kind of a new move to of interest. And we're going to see some of the other things like the personal income and Kansas City Fed and, obviously the Richmond Fed's going to be coming out. We'll see if that actually goes. I will tell you, though, that in the past, the Tuesday that we call the Magic Tuesday, when you see the consumer confidence come out on the 10 o'clock hour, right after you see the Case-Shiller numbers come out before the market at 9 o'clock, has been an interesting day of turnarounds. And that has to do more so, I think, with the end-of-the-month phenomena, window dressing, and kind of the time when you'd have to start running it up for the end-of-the-month fees for a lot of these.
Turnaround Tuesday.
Yep, turnaround Tuesday. But we'll see that next week, so we'll see what happens.
You might say to yourself, well, how could there be a recession if it looks like some of this coincidental data, coincidental meaning happening now, looks like it's improving.
Right.
And you only have to look over to Europe. You know, what's happening in Europe? The European leaders are essentially forcing a recession on the region.
Mm-hmm.
By forcing banks to take losses, and by forcing them to recap, that is to mean shrink their loan books. They're going to constrict lending across Europe, and that's going to worsen the recession that's happening there right now. Now, Europe is our largest trading partner, and so if Europeans are buying less stuff, you know, it's going to impact U.S. GDP. And I really think that the transmission mechanism for recession comes through Europe.
I hear you. And then we also have to look at the results of Asia, which hit a low last week while everybody was else popping up. I don't know if they're smarter or not than
one of the smartest fund managers that I know is Jeff Greenlock over at Double Line Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the number one leading indicator for the U.S. stock market is the Shanghai Composite. And the Shanghai Composite was down 4.5% last week while everything else was up.
Mm-hmm. And I got to send you, you've seen my offset of the Shanghai versus the U.S. stock market by 120 days, which was the time period between when they initiated their initial stimulus, that, you know, back when, and then how long it took us to initiate ours. It follows pretty well. And if you look at that, differential, it looks like that our market should be right where they are, possibly actually very overvalued comparatively. So it's a very interesting situation. John Markman.
Well, I have some good news. Can I give you a little good news?
I was going to ask you, is there anything good you could share with me?
Absolutely. I don't like to be negative. I just want to call them as I see them. I want to help preserve people's portfolios and make sure that they have enough to save for their retirement, for their kids' education. And I don't want to be negative. I just want to make sure that people are prepared and sort of bat down the hatches in case.
I hear you.
You know,
so what's the good news?
What's the good
news?
But the good news is this. If you do a monthly chart of the S&P 500,
mm-hmm.
and you draw a line from the 2007 high
mm-hmm.
To the most recent high in July, if you draw that line on the chart, you can look at the decline that occurred in 2009 as the head of a big inverse head and shoulders bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The shoulders occur in 2008 on the one hand, on the other hand, the shoulder was just completed a few months ago at that low on October 3rd. So, if you draw that line, the market looks like the pattern looks like a big cup with handle pattern.
Yep.
And in order for that pattern to be activated, you need a move up in the S&P 500 above 1280.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's one very positive pattern, and I'll tell you how positive it is in a second. Another way you can look at the big monthly pattern is by drawing a head and shoulders line across the two recent shoulders in 2008 and the one that we just had. And in that case, you get a very incredibly lovely looking inverse head and shoulders bottom. Again, it's only activated with a close above 1280 on the S&P 500. And that's the same level that I've been talking about with the recession call. Okay, so what I want to point out to you is that if you measure the potential gain of the market based on either the cup with handle pattern or the inverse head and shoulders pattern, if it's validated, the S&P 500 should go to 1930 over the next couple of years, which is about 700 points higher than where it is now.
Not directly.
Not directly, but you know, over time, over a few years, it should take about as long as it took to move down. So from 2007 to 2009, it should go up over the next couple of years.
Does that also mean that we won't have a recession theoretically?
Theoretically, that's what it that is what it would imply.
Right.
So that's something to look forward to. Now, understand, it's not activated unless the price moves above the neckline
and closes there and closes.
And closes above it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if that were to occur, you might say, well, why would that occur? It would occur because the markets would have confidence in whatever solution the Europeans came up with, and it would mean that the bond market had approved of the changes that were made in Europe and were willing to finance whatever it is, whatever mechanisms the Europeans come up with for solving their problem.
Yeah, we'll
because
see.
The credit markets can decide. They can decide that the Europeans are credible, and if they do decide that, then the recession is off, and we're going to be having a great 2012-2013.
Well,
I don't think that's not the most likely scenario, but I want to throw that out.
Well, I appreciate that. In CNBC style, giving us that silver lining, we very much appreciate that and appreciate you coming on board. That's all the time we're going to have. John Markman, you're going to be a very happy man either way, I'm sure, because you are also one of those guys that, you know, looks at the situation and calls it as it is. So I think that's really great. You have some great books out. Gemini 252, is also there for you. So we're going to put all that information on the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, as well as your email, your Twitter handle. We'll make sure everybody goes and visits you and annoys you. Go check him out. And thank you for all the information he's provided. Thanks for joining us today, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye-bye. So, Kevin, you know, we have a lot we went over on the futures. We talked about the whole idea of, the risk that's out there in terms of recession. And I think you and I want to talk a little bit about how the, some of the Apple issue, you know, the things with the Apple. I'll tell you a quick story. I don't know if I told you this. I was down in South Beach this weekend.
Right.
And I went in South Beach and I noticed, I was just walking around, and two things I was looking at. Well, maybe three, but two things I was looking at down South Beach. One was the incredible food that was going on down there, the seafood, the shrimps, all that stuff. And then the phones. Everybody has an iPhone. Everybody. Okay?
Of course, yeah.
So I went over to the Apple store.
Right.
Because I was thinking about getting the iPhone 4S and turning mine in. And I went there at 5 after 8. 5 after 8. At Lincoln Road in South Beach. I walked in and said, do you have any iPhone 4Ss for the AT&T? They said, yes, we do. I said, great. Do you have the 32 gig? Yes, we do. I said, that's great. I'd like one. I'm sorry, sir. We don't sell them after 8 o'clock at night.
Why is that?
I'm not sure.
That doesn't make any sense.
I think they didn't like me.
Open past 8?
They're open until like 10.
But they won't sell an iPhone?
Mm-mm.
Does that have to do with the network?
I'm not quite sure. All I know is they said something about inventory, whatever. They said, but you can do it. You can go onto the website after 9 p.m. at night. And you can go and get yourself a reservation and it'll deliver it tomorrow. So I said, okay, that's interesting. And you know what happened then?
What's that?
Well, I went on the website and I ordered the phone. And as soon as I pushed the button to actually buy it, to make the reservation to pick it up, it said the network error, server error, like 25 times.
Right.
So I waited a half hour. Then what happened? You know the rest of the story, right?
Oh, yeah. It sold out.
Sold out.
For sure.
Anyway, why is it that Apple stock, though, really didn't catch fire? Was it just simply because it caught so much fire prior to the move up? Was it that much of a disappointment? What's the story with it?
I'm not sure if there was necessarily a disappointment in the iPhone 4S. I mean, I think people were expecting a new design, obviously. But I think as far as their earnings go, I think people just delayed their purchases. And instead of buying iPhone 4s or even old 3GSs, they wanted to wait for that new one to come out.
The 5. They wanted a 5.
You wanted the 5.
You're waiting.
I'm still sitting on my 3GS because what's the point?
Exactly. Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I played with the phone the other night. I played with this new Siri thing and all that. It's fun to play with, and then I'm not sure what I'll use it for. But we'll see in the future. It's good probably for cars and things of that nature. Copper. I want to talk about this. Copper. Copper has been recently at a low price, and the lowest price since 2009. It went up about, 100% after the 2009 dip, goes up, and then it just slams down. And you and I looked at the pricing of this, and we said, well, on one hand, it's kind of good. because and I was kind of shaking my head going, I can't believe this discussion we're having. But
well, yeah, I mean, there's always, you can take things one way or another, but you know, with copper being down, you know, that's a really good indication for businesses. I mean, we've seen
it an indication for business or good for business?
Well, it's good for businesses because right. The prices for their goods or their material costs have been lowered. So a lot of electronic companies use copper. A lot of you know, the big companies like GE, they use a lot of copper.
And the building business.
Yeah, buildings, and yeah, you have copper piping and plumbing and whatnot. But really, I mean, this could be a good thing for the businesses because, you know, we've seen these PPI costs, which is the producer price index. We've really seen them rise,
mm-hmm.
and they really haven't passed that down to the consumers. And so now that they're, you know, some of these companies are catching a break maybe on some of this pricing, it might help them increase their margins and pass that on to the bottom line.
All right, that's a good story. Now, tell me the other story when copper prices are up. Wow, that's good.
Oh sure, yeah, copper prices. Copper price is up. That's really good because, you know, it means that the demand is much higher for copper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people are buying more copper, therefore mm-hmm. the demand is higher.
So therefore, if there's a major buying of copper by China, that's a good thing because there's infrastructure expansion.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But if there's not, it's good for companies because
it's cheaper cost.
Cheaper. So it's never bad for anything, copper prices.
Well, there's always some determination. It just depends on how you want to look at it.
Well, the discussion was that a lot of this has to do with China, and they really took a look at the inventories. The inventories are 2 times higher than they had anticipated, and a lot of the ordering of copper is slowing down, and that has to do with the fact that there's a bigger slowdown than everybody really thinks or that has been really transmitted through the whole China area, through the Asian region. That's
right.
The big concern.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at it from, you know, like you're saying, from that perspective. But the problem that you run into is we're only looking at one metal,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you really have to look at everything in the whole economy. Although we've used copper as kind of a quote unquote indicator,
right,
for the market, you know, and that's been good. But, you know, sometimes things change. You know, over time, people stop using copper and use nickel.
What about lumber? Have you seen lumber prices? You know, lumber prices have been going down substantially. I mean, you know, you see back in March, they were as high as, $327 on the future on lumber. Now they're like $235.
Yeah, but who uses lumber anymore to build, right?
What are they building with? Copper? Back to that again?
Copper, brick.
No, nobody's using brick. Yeah, okay. So there's no brick. Is it brick futures?
I don't know.
I don't think there's brick futures.
I'm just saying. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a slowdown, especially in the commodity sector. We've seen a lot of the commodities pull back quite a bit.
Right.
And whether you want to say that's a slowdown, there's some the recession coming, then, you know, that's also a possibility. And there's also there's obviously less demand. I mean, it's just there's no escaping that.
Yeah. So what about there's two other things I want to talk to you about, and we're going a little over time today, but hopefully everybody's enjoying all the things we have to talk about here and getting a little bit out of this. One of the things is the bond managers are having a really tough time this year. It seems like Bill Gross has been grousing recently about, he made a bad call. He apologized, all this other stuff. And he was on the wrong side because he really went to the other side, thinking that there was no way.
Yeah, he was actually short treasuries, mm-hmm. I think. And you know what? These bond managers are really having a difficult time. And the reason for that is there's so much government manipulation and the government's really getting their hands involved in everything, and it's making it very difficult for anybody to kind of look and see what's going on with the market. You know, if your normal intuition, you know, and Bill Gross's normal intuition probably would have been to short treasuries, but, you know, he didn't realize that the Fed and Ben Bernanke were going to do, you know, this Operation Twist. He didn't realize they're going to do QE1, QE2, and now we're talking about QE3.
I think he realized it, but he didn't realize to the extent they were willing to go.
Oh yeah, I mean it really has been an amazing time for the Federal Reserve, and I don't think there's ever been a time that we've had rates at zero to whatever it is, 25 basis points.
I heard they're going to reduce them.
I don't know how that's possible.
We're going to go to zero to This is very stimulating to the economy.
That's very
think
possible.
Think about that. And then they're going to go to zero to 1/32.
Wow.
Yeah, and that is, we're talking about boom times.
That's
boom
big time.
Times.
But I'm telling you, we have been at this low rate for 2 years now.
Yeah.
I mean, this has never happened.
Yeah, and you would think that the banks would do much better in this, but they really started to mess around with the yield curve with that Operation Twist. We talked about this at length in our quarterly commentary that we do, you know, that we send out to clients. We go, every quarter we go over, okay, what is happening and what do we believe, you know, is the outcome from that? As a matter of fact, this quarter, we went back about 3 years and we looked at all of our different calls and color-coded in about two or three pages what our major topics were, what we were calling, and if we were right or wrong. That was a kind of interesting exercise, I thought.
Right.
I'm going to see about, we may be making some of this available the next few weeks on the Disciplined Investor website. It was sent out to clients before, so they get it first, of course. But what we're going to do is I think we'll make it available to everybody that listens. But we just talked about the yen. What is the deal with the yen? What is the problem with the yen?
I'm not sure.
I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Yes. To be honest, I have no idea what's wrong with the yen, other than the fact when you compare it to the U.S. dollar, I can understand the fact that, you know, we continue to devalue our currency.
Well, they're trying to do it too, though. They want it. Well, they can't.
No, that's not true. They want to, but they're not doing anything about it.
Well, they're doing a lot of talking.
They do a lot of talking.
A lot of blowhards over there.
But we're doing a lot of creating. I mean, we're creating a ton of money here. I mean, we're talking between QE1, QE2, and if we do this QE3 stuff, I mean, we're talking about creating a lot of cash and a lot of stimulus.
The QE3, I will take QE1 to QE2. I gotcha. Twist, you know, whatever.
But that's
the QE3. I'm not.
But I think that's what we saw on Friday. I think there was some hints in there.
There was no question. There was two hints. You had Chirillo on Thursday, and then you had Yellen on Friday talking about it. And there's some other guys in the background. But here's the thing.
And then you saw the currencies move. That was the big kicker right there.
I agree. I think there's the repatriation trade in Europe. I think that's part of it. I also think I agree with you that there's a discussion about the QE3. But you know that Bernanke this week and over the last few weeks has been talking about that the tool that they're going to start using is the communication and transparency tool.
Right.
Now, let's give you the behind-the-scenes look of what communications and transparency is. And if you look at any kind of the reports and information available about what transparency and communication is, it's basically talking the market the direction they want it to go.
Right.
Is it possible?
No, but that's the thing, is you don't know what
you don't
this
know.
Government, you don't know
they're
what
lunatics.
This Fed is gonna do.
They're lunatics.
You really don't.
Yeah.
So they can talk and they can talk about QE3 all they want, but the fact that it's in your mind and they will do it if they need to, that's big.
There's a word for that. It's a mind something.
Scare tactic.
Yeah, it's a mind F. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what it is. That's what they do. Yeah. But that's what their intent is. I mean, you know what? They got to be having a good time. Seriously. Check out what I'm going to do tomorrow.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. I mean, the Fed is really doing the best that they can to make the market go up. It's really our fiscal policy that we need to change.
Yeah, good luck. I mean, they are doing. I think we all agree that the Fed is basically out of bullets from a traditional sense.
Right.
And they have to use a very creative cycle. It's almost like a psychological attack.
Yep.
What they're doing to make sure that there's confidence. Because really, at the end of the day, it's all about confidence.
Right.
If there's no confidence, you're not going to do something. If there is confidence, you may, you know, actually buy. So, all right, let's wrap it up with, I think the only other thing that I want to look at is, you know, that we'll see next week if this whole Yahoo thing comes down. You know, we saw that now this conversation about Microsoft maybe buying, Google coming behind the scenes and looking at maybe funding somebody that's going to buy it. Steve Ballmer says no high ranking or high management is talking with Yahoo. And then you got Yang, of course, saying, you know, that's what he does. The Yang puppet. Oh, it's not for sale. It's not for sale. Yeah, that's what he does all the time, right? We'll probably talk about this a little bit more on the DH Unplugged show this week. But it's kind of a free-for-all right now, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand why anybody would want to buy Yahoo. I mean, I don't know where the synergies are there other than advertisement space and the brand recognition, the brand
name. They
have
it already, though. Microsoft has a partnership already.
Yeah.
Google can't buy it because of antitrust.
Yeah.
Even behind the scenes.
I'm just not sure who would be a good fit for Yahoo. I really just don't see it.
Maybe, you probably start hearing that Apple's going to buy him soon.
I mean, I could see maybe a merger between maybe LinkedIn or something like that.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, there'd at least be some synergies there. But
I guess. I don't know. Anyway, we're going to end it on that note. I want to thank you, Kevin, for coming. We're going to have Stocktoberfest, of course, all throughout the next couple of weeks. And we'll have our regular analysis over on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Make sure to go over to podcastawards.com and cast your vote, please. I would really appreciate it. Go over to iTunes also and put in your comments on the show. And, of course, if you want any information on the things we talked about on the show, just go over the show notes. We'll have all sorts of information to point you in the right direction, whether it's over at DeMarkman, Twitter, whether it's some of the stocks we talked about, whether it's our management and how we manage money. And you can see a quick, 12-minute video on that. Until the next time we meet, we have some really good guests coming on. We have a couple of guys are trying to line up that we've been in and out on recently. We have Mark Faber, who is looks like he's going to be coming on shortly.
We talked about talking with Vitaly, no?
Yep, Vitaly Katnison is going to be coming on. We talked to him last week about the whole Europe thing and a few other areas. We also have Joe Brusselis from Bloomberg, The Economist, that we're lining up. So there's a lot of good stuff happening, and I hope you join me. Thanks for your emails. Send anything you want to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next time, have a profitable week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.